supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Do you consider yourself an ambitious person? Do you want your children to be ambitious? But think about it. What is ambition, really? We ask our children what they want to be when they grow up, fireman, doctor, soccer player, the usual answers. I must say, I asked my 5-year-old buddy what he wanted to be when he grew up, and he says, "How do I know? I'm only 5 years old." Anyway, we want our kids to be ambitious, or so we think. On today's show, we're talking about ambition and its effects. The broader answer to that question, not just what do you want to be when you grow up, but who do you want to be? What kind of person do you want to be that includes qualities such as compassion, good relationships, and a sense of well-being that accompanies them? We'd love to hear from you on today's show and what ambition means to you, whether you consider yourself ambitious, whether you want your children to be ambitious. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We'd love to hear from you early in the show because I have a feeling our phone lines are going to get backed up pretty early. Well, we're going to be joined. One of our guests, our first guest, is from California. She's Dr. Christine Carter. She's a senior fellow at Greater Good Science Center in Berkeley. She's the author of The Sweet Spot and Raising Happiness, and she's going to help us put ambition and relationships in perspective with some science about our brains later on. Well, we have Emily Esfahani Smith with us on the line. That is my mistake. She writes about culture, relationships, and psychology for many publications, including The Atlantic, New York Times, and Wall Street Journal. Well, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Emily, you know, your article is 2 years old, but it really, really sparked some controversy here. And frankly, I never even thought about the whole concept of ambition or the price of ambition. You made a very provocative statement in your article. You said, "Ambition moves people forward, relationships and community, by imposing limits, hold people back." Where did that come from, and is that true in your mind?
Well, I was responding to precisely the dilemma that you set up earlier in the show, that so much of our childhoods, our teenage years, are preparing us to, you know, get good grades, do well on the exams, get into a good school, get a great job. And we're not being prepared in a similar way to maintain our relationships, to put our families first, to think about starting our own families. And so this whole idea of the tension between ambition and our relationships really kind of started bubbling to the surface for me when I was graduating from college and seeing all of my friends and the people I love and myself kind of facing this challenge of, you know, where we all have to make decisions about where we're going next, about whether, you know, if we're ambitious, you know, if we're going to go back to our hometowns, whether it's somewhere in Louisiana, like the gentleman who I wrote about in that article, or whether we're going to go to the kind of power and money centers, which are New York, Washington, Philadelphia, other places where a lot of the jobs are. And I just see so many young people making the decision to pursue their careers at the expense of everything else. You know, we see, like, for example, the age of marriage is rising, measures of individualism are rising, measures of materialism and wealth seeking, which I think can be proxies of ambition, are rising, while at the same time, so are measures of loneliness and things like that. So I think we see in this culture, in our culture, this are prioritizing ambition and the fruits of ambition, like wealth and status, at the expense of our relationships.
Yeah, and we don't even know what ambition is to each one of us individually. Do you consider yourself an ambitious person?
I do. Yes, I do.
So,
and perhaps that's, you know, part of what inspired me to write that article and to look into the research was, you know, this own tension that I had between wanting to preserve and honor my relationships and yet being career oriented.
So what does ambition mean to you?
I think when I think about ambition, I think about it in the career and education domain, kind of continually rising the ladder, aspiring for the, you know, whether it's more influence or more wealth or more prestige in terms of career or, you know, your educational goalposts. I think that you can also be, of course, ambitious in your relationships. You can have the ambition to be a great spouse or a great mother or a great daughter, things like that. But I think that, you know, when I'm using the term ambition in that article, and I think when we use it in our culture, we tend to be thinking about the public domain. So our public selves, which is our, you know, our career selves and the identity that we derive from the work that we do.
I have to tell you, years ago, I gave a talk, Emily, at a high school in a suburb of Philadelphia. I spoke to seniors, and it was early in the year, and they were under a great deal of stress. So I asked, you know, what are you stressed about? I mean, I'm a psychologist, so I ask questions. I don't give answers. So what are you stressed about? Well, we've got to get into the best college we can. All right. So these are ambitious kids, right?
Right.
So why do you want to get into the best college? So we can get the best grades, so we can get the best job, so we can get in the best medical school, law school, whatever, graduate school. Okay. And then again, I say why. And I keep asking why. And so they, you know, so they can get a leg up on their career, so they can be successful, so they can. And I keep asking why. And then they say, so we can be happy. And I ask the question, what is happiness? And they didn't know the answer.
Huh.
So what is the goal of all this ambition? Or is it in our hard wiring? I mean, when we get Christine on the phone, we're going to ask her about the brain science here. But is ambition in our hard wiring, you think?
I think, and I'm sure Christina will be able to speak to this more. But I think certainly, if you think about, you know, our kind of historical legacy and evolution and things like that, we our species has always needed, just for survival's sake, to kind of be on the lookout for the next best thing in terms of resources. And so I think that mentality of like resource accumulation is still with us, and it's still such a powerful driver of everything that we do, even though we no longer live in that kind of dangerous evolutionary environment where food was scarce and we needed to kind of constantly be jockeying for power and things like that. So I think that's absolutely a part of it. And I think the happiness point is such an interesting one, because in my research for that article, I came across a study by a woman at the University of Pennsylvania, Cassie McGillner, who showed kind of something similar to what these seniors said to you, which is that the emotion that people think about most when they think about money is happiness. So they think that, you know, the more money you have, the happier you can be. And so the happiness is the goalpost. But the means of getting there, money, I think that's where the problem is. There's been so much work, so much research showing that money, materialism doesn't make people happy, that what makes people happy are relationships, you know, community, things like that. And yet we have this mindset, maybe it's because of our evolutionary legacy, our hardwiring, as you said, that money, resources, status will get us there.
If you're just tuning in to the show, we're talking about ambition and the relationship between ambition and relationships, family, what ambition really means. We've been talking with Emily Estefani Smith, who writes about culture and relationships. The article that she wrote, a wonderful article in The Atlantic a couple of years ago that provoked this show. Our number is 888-477-9499. Give us a call. Are you ambitious? And what does that mean to you? 888-477-9499. Well, now we're also joined by Christine Carter, who's the senior fellow at the Greater Good Science Center in Berkeley. She's the author of The Sweet Spot and Raising Happiness. Christine, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So can you answer the big question here? What is ambition? Is it a personality trait? Is it genetically based? Is it in our evolutionary genes? Is it environmental?
Yeah.
And don't give me this all of the above stuff.
Well, it's interesting because the truth is that of course there's a personality aspect to it, but it's much, in my opinion, and you're speaking to a sociologist now, and so this is my educated opinion, not, you know, we don't have a ton of scientific evidence that I'm aware of one way or another, but this is something that is very culturally based, that our society teaches certain forms of ambition, which, you know, if you look in other cultures, they don't have the same sort of emphasis. So while certainly there is a personality aspect to this, but that personality aspect might not actually look like ambition the way we might be thinking about it.
What do you mean?
So a kid who from a personality standpoint, from a genetic standpoint, who is more likely to be conscientious, say, which we know is heavily genetic, and a people pleaser, somebody who wants to look good to other people, right? So those kinds of things are going to be more influenced by what the culture says success is, and they're going to look more ambitious than somebody who, just from a personality standpoint, doesn't care as much
what other people think. Let me stop you with your language. You said they're going to look more ambitious. Why that language?
Oh, well, you know, I think because the language I'm using is as a scientific observer, right? So that's just my framing. You might say that they would be more ambitious, right? To me, I don't necessarily know. I'm just looking for evidence one way or another. That's just my perspective. So, but you could say it other way.
So I wouldn't have the guts to say it the other way. But you're right. Point well taken. Listen, Christine, and I want you to chime in on this also, Emily. One of the definitions I read about ambition was this, quote, an eager or strong desire to achieve something such as fame or power. That sounds like ambition is all about the self. Christine, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's all about the self in relation to other people, right? Fame, you're not famous all alone, right? That involves other people. Power involves other people, right? It's a hierarchy. So the way we typically think of ambition is somebody who has who's higher up in the hierarchy. Right, they are striving, they're rising. The way that we conceptualize ambition is superiority. You know, it's a very hierarchical kind of a thing. Now, yes, it's the individual gaining status, but you're never alone in this. You can't have status alone, right? It involves other people.
Emily, I want to hear you weigh in on that definition. Is ambition about the self, in your mind?
I think that definition
I think it's certainly a definition that when we use the word ambitious in our culture, that's what people think of. It's like Christine said, it's rising on the hierarchy. And I think, like I said before, I think that there are people who can certainly have the ambition of being, you know, the best, you know, parent possible or the best giver possible, but that's not, they don't typically describe themselves as ambitious people, and we don't typically think of them as ambitious in the way of like career success, wealth, status, things like that. And I just wanted to add to what Christine was saying, I think that one of the reasons why ambition can kind of be at odds with our relationships is because if we're constantly striving in this social setting, like if we're constantly trying to rise above the next person, it's kind of this really competitive mindset that you have. And I think it makes you see the next person as an obstacle that you need to kind of overcome, or as someone who is getting in your way. So like if you're in a romantic relationship that's constraining you, constraining your career or whatever, then all of a sudden your romantic partner is an obstacle. Or if you have a family who kind of wants you to come back home, to Louisiana, but you want to go to New York and be a writer, that's an obstacle that's constraining you. So this ambitious mindset, I think, kind of breeds competitiveness that then can make you, you know, just erode your relationships to others.
You know, Springsteen said in his autobiography is essentially the same thing, Emily, you said in that quote in your article about how ambition moves people forward and relationships hold people back. I mean, he said he had to make a decision, you know, that relationships and you know, these connections were going to hold him back, and he had to be single-minded and devoting himself to his music. Of course, he also said in that same autobiography how misguided he was, and that relationships ultimately help his
right.
career and the quality of his music.
I think that the ambitious mindset is a competitive one, and it's not just home versus work, but that it starts to happen in the workplace as well, and that it is in both places misguided, right? So the sense that I'm trying to gain status and, you know, at all costs or even nicely, right, it just sets you up to be competing with everybody around you, and that it's this attitude of that there is a zero-sum game, right? That if you get promoted, I will not. If you succeed, I will not. Therefore, or if I succeed, you cannot also succeed. And that does very much hurt our relationships. It, of course, hurts our happiness. Like Springsteen eventually understood, it's very misguided, both in the workplace, in terms of our overall success, if you define success as the ability to fulfill your potential or your organization's potential, but then, of course, at home, in our relationships, and with our overall
so
happiness.
So let me, Christine, before we have to take a break, can we have too much ambition?
Yes. Absolutely, especially as we're defining it here, right? So I don't think that we can necessarily have too much success, depending on how you define success, right? But yes, we can have too much ambition. That striving, that competition isn't always bad, but it can definitely become toxic.
Yeah, and it enables us to focus inward, which is part of the difficulty in our culture today. So many people are focused inward, and our lens is so very narrow. And I have a feeling you addressed that, Christine, in some of your work, some of your writing. So we'll talk about that after our break. We're talking about ambition today on Voices in the Family. What it is, can we have too much? Obviously, we heard from Christine that we can have too much. What is it really, and what is the goal of ambition? What's the goal of ambition in your life? What do you want it to be in your children's lives? We're talking with Christine Carter. She's a senior fellow at the Greater Good Science Center in Berkeley, incredibly good center. I encourage you to look it up. She's the author of The Sweet Spot and Raising Happiness. Emily, as Fahani Smith writes about culture, relationships, and psychology for many publications, including The Atlantic, New York Times, and The Wall Street Journal. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
I'm Dr. Russell Kaufman for the Wistar Institute, a proud supporter of WHYY. With the opening of our new seven-story Robert and Penny Fox Tower, Wistar Science is able to accelerate its efforts to create new cancer therapies. Our discoveries can help understand why cancers spread and are the basis for new Wistar drugs that target and attack the cause of advanced prostate cancer. Learn more about Wistar Science at wistar.org. Wistar Science saves lives.
What do you want to hear on WHYY next fiscal year? This is Ed Cunningham. WHYY's current fiscal year is about to end on June 30th. We need to hear from you during our June FM campaign so that we can bring you what you want to hear in fiscal year 16. Making our goals now determines what we can do for you starting July 1st. Please take a moment to visit WHYY.org to make a gift. And thank you.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about ambition, the good news and the bad news. Our number is 888-477-9499. We're talking with Emily Esfahani Smith and Christine Carter. And I want to ask you, Emily, in your article, you used the phrase culture of ambition. Is that an accurate description? Is that our culture? And, are many of the European countries as ambitious?
I think, that's a great question. I think that, I certainly think that we do live in a culture of ambition. One of the statistics that I remember looking up, I can't remember if I included it in my article, but it was from the American Freshman Survey, which is this survey that since the 1960s has been asking college freshmen about their values in life. And when the survey first got started in the 60s, college freshmen said that things like developing a meaningful life philosophy, starting a family, helping others, just in general being kind of more service-oriented, being more others-oriented, that those were their top values. Today, if you look at what freshmen say their top values are, it's very much the kinds of things that we've been talking about. It's material wealth, making a lot of money, good jobs, things like this. So there's been this, and then the other values like starting a family, helping others, developing a meaningful life philosophy have fallen way, way down. So I think over time, we've definitely seen this emergence of a culture of ambition in this country. But I also think it's part of the historical legacy of our country. If you think about why the settlers came to America in the first place, they wanted a new opportunity. They wanted a life better for themselves than what they had before. It's still very much why immigrants come to this country. And I think, I think we've kind of been trashing ambition, but I think that there's really something to be said for also being ambitious and wanting a better life than the one that maybe you left behind or the one that you were that you had as a child. So I think it is a big part of our culture, and it can be a good thing, but it can also be a bad thing if it's taken, in excess.
I wonder what caused the change here, and I'm going to talk to you, Christine, and I wonder if some of it is economic. My grandparents came to this country. My parents were first generation. They were ambitious. They wanted to, have their children have a better lives than they had. They wanted to help mm-hmm. us get to college, all those things. And, it's a different world now economically,
Right, right. Well, I mean, I think, yes, it's a very different world. It's very different culturally, too. So I think we're looking at a very long legacy, the Protestant ethic and the American dream all speak to this core desirability of ambition. And there is nothing wrong with that as it's defined. I think we have to look at how ambition has shifted a little bit. Because really, when you look at, you know, our grandparents' generation, their ambition was motivation to, you know, have a better life than their parents did, or to make a better life for their children. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that, especially because it wasn't particularly competitive, right? It wasn't individual. It was that, you know, our grandparents lived in these very rich communities. They had a lot more social ties than we tend to have. And it was the sort of, you know, rising tides raise all boats mentality, right? It wasn't me over you. But if we look back to the definition of ambition that you used several minutes ago, it was much more about becoming famous and powerful. Now, that is very different than wanting to make a better life for your children than what you have, right? Ambition to be famous or to be powerful in that sort of celebrity kind of a way looks a lot more like greed, and it looks a lot more competitive.
You know,
so I think.
Go on.
Go ahead.
In the early 19. Your turn.
No, you. Early 19.
In the early 1900s, we really had a culture of character, and character meant
right.
everything about who you were as a person. And
right.
shortly thereafter, it became all about how you look, how you appear, and how you come across in the workplace.
Absolutely. And not just how you come across in the workplace, but how you come across on social media. I mean, if we look at a lot of the, you know, the ways the media have shaped what we see about each other and our perceived values. Now, I'm not saying that we all do value these things, but if you were visiting from outer space or from another country or whatever, and you just looked at what we're all looking at and what kids are aspiring to these days, you know, what you see on reality TV or on Instagram are the values portrayed there are very, very different than I think our grandparents would be very disappointed in us, you know, that their values were different. So were they less ambitious? No, I actually think that they were more ambitious.
Oh, sure they were.
In some ways. Yeah, and they were more motivated. I think that they were harder working, but it's a different kind of ambition than we're actually talking about now. That kind of ambition I have no problem with, right? I don't have any problem with hard work. I don't have, especially if you're doing it in the service of other people.
I don't even think you need to finish that sentence. In the service of, you know, if we're doing it as an act of service, we're more likely to be happy, yes?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The more we use words like I, me, and mine in an interview, for example, the more likely it is that we have heart disease.
That's what the Buddha said. The Buddha said, if you can summarize all my teaching into one sentence, it's to disavow everything that begins with I, me, or mine.
Right.
I want to shift here just a little bit. And Emily, you know, we talk about the ideal of having both and understanding both. But Nelson Mandela, in his autobiography, he made a conscious decision to choose his beliefs and what his life was about over being an involved father and husband. It was a very difficult decision for him. And this is what he chose. He paid the price, but the world is better because of it.
It is. That's one of the kind of great, great moral dilemmas of the ambitious person who is ambitious in the sense of wanting to serve others, as you two were talking about earlier. It's to what extent is your moral obligations lie primarily to those immediately around you, like your family, your friends, your community, versus the greater duty you might have to make the world a better place for millions and millions, you know, millions and millions of people, possibly. I think Gandhi faced a similar dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of artists throughout history who decided that their art would benefit the world to such a tremendous degree that they felt morally justified to abandon their families. You know, we could debate with whether that's true, but, you know, people like Paul Gauguin certainly, made that decision. And is the world, well, put Gauguin aside, but for people like Gandhi and Mandela, the world is absolutely a better place with their contributions. But I think that, you know, and we certainly want their contributions in the world, but I do think also that, you know, it's not just kind of a numbers game, like, you know, they helped millions of people by not putting so much attention to their family. Their family, let's say, has five people in it. There are millions of people that they helped, so it's ultimately better that they helped those millions versus, you know, the sacrifice of their family. I think there's also something to be said about the unique role that, you know, people like Mandela and Gandhi have to their family. Like, nobody else can fill the shoes of Nelson Mandela, of being the father to Nelson Mandela's children. Like, so, same with Gandhi. And so I think, you know, while we praise them for what they did, I think we have to also recognize that there's a real moral cost. And maybe we're willing to accept that moral cost as a society, but we shouldn't downplay it.
I want to, before we take our break, Christine, what is the ultimate goal of ambition? Happiness? I mean, I noticed in your blog, you say that your mission is to teach science-based practices to increase happiness, but isn't the pursuit of happiness a surefire way to be miserable?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, I think to the extent, I mean, that's a whole other conversation about, you know, how we're defining happiness, but if it leads to just focusing on yourself so much. But to the extent that we all want to be happy, I think a lot of people are pursuing ambition and fame misguidedly because they think that they will lead more satisfying lives if they have more power, for example. It's interesting, this conflict, though, between Mandela's family, for example. I just want to throw out there an idea, and that is that I think that we have evolved beyond the point where there needs to be a sacrifice any further. We are still limited by, you know, what we can accomplish in any one given day, for sure. But the world is really different than it was a generation ago. And I think we have the technology now where we can accomplish a lot more in our work lives and then draw solace from our family lives, that what we give to our family, that it's no longer a zero-sum game, right? That we can accomplish a lot towards the greater good of the our society or the world or whatever it is that is meaningful to us, and that it is not necessarily at odds with our families. Now, structurally, we're not totally set up that way, but from an actual, you know, that conflict is more perceived than real in my mind.
When you
look at what it takes to really
it is,
achieve.
It is, and it is, we know the facts that it's not a zero-sum game. And I
right.
just want to float this question out to you and for me, both of us being teachers. And I'm not looking for an answer, but how do we teach that truth in a way that people are able to change the way they think about their lives? Because certainly a good speech is not going to do it. And that's a personal struggle of mine. So that's just something to think about while we take our break. We've just been talking with Christine Carter, who's a senior fellow at the Greater Good Science Center at Berkeley. We're also talking about Emily as Fonnie Smith. She writes about culture and relationships and psychology for many publications, including The Atlantic, The Times, and The Wall Street Journal. Our number is 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on 90 WHYY FM.
Karen Treatment Center supports WHYY. Is someone you care about struggling, losing interest in activities they loved? Changes like these can be a sign of drug and alcohol abuse. As a behavioral health care and addiction treatment center, Karen helps families understand when professional help is warranted, offering therapies that restore wellness in body, mind, and spirit. A confidential assessment is available at 855-894-4325 or at karen.org. That's CARON.org.
I'm Robin Young.
This ruling will strengthen all of our communities by offering to all loving same-sex couples the dignity of marriage across this great land.
So the Supreme Court has ruled in favor of same-sex marriage and Obamacare, but wait, there's more. How will they rule on lethal injections? Maybe we'll know next time on Here and Now.
Get more interesting today at 1 on WHYY.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about achievement and relationships. We're talking about ambition and relationships. It's an A word. We're talking with Christine Carter and Emily Esfahani Smith, both of whom are experts in their own way. Christine, so on a personal level, what are your thoughts mm-hmm. about how we can teach this in you know, that it really isn't a zero-sum game, that you really can have both? How can we teach this in a way that will actually help people change?
Yeah, well, I think the most important thing is to help people see and then experience the fact that these two things aren't at odds, and in fact that when you have a rich and fulfilling personal life, when you have rich relationships, you have access to a totally different part of your brain so that it can make you more successful, right? So when we are happier, when we're in rich relationships, our brain, we have access to our most intelligent, most creative, most productive parts of our brain, right? So we're actually able to do better work and to have a greater impact on the world. Now, I can tell people this until I'm blue in the face. I can show them the science around this, and it takes a while to seep in. But I think once people have the experience of being in a really joyful place in their life, where their lives are rich with positive relationships, they can experience how much more productive, how much more effective, how much more impact they can have on the lives of other people.
I don't want to play with words here, but in my experience professionally, that what we really want beyond happiness, or maybe as a component of happiness, is well-being. Just a sense
right.
that we can be in a place and let out this deep, it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's okay now, and we're okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's a sense of well-being. And, happiness comes and goes, you know, but well-being can be a substrate of our existence.
Absolutely. I think we often confuse happiness with gratification, right? So you're sort of comparing and contrasting, pleasure or gratification, that type of happiness, with well-being, which is another type of happiness. It's more of a contentedness or whatever. And I think it's really an important distinction to make, to understand that, you know, all the ads that are out there telling us that we'll be happier if we have a certain type of car or longer eyelashes or the latest skinny jeans or whatever, that's the gratification form of happiness. It's not a positive emotion. It doesn't register in our brain like joy does or contentedness does or even passion does. It it triggers the reward center in our brain, which ultimately leaves us wanting. It creates a, you know, that dopamine hit in our brain from when we, you know, get something gratifying, when we have a gratifying moment, whether it's an achievement or a purchase or, you know, a really pleasurable experience, that feels good in the moment. But like you said, it comes and goes. And actually, from a biochemical standpoint, when it goes, it leaves us with a feeling of desire for more.
Sure.
And that craving or desire is not happiness.
No, quite the contrary. So I've been hogging both of you for the whole show, and we've got a lot of people who want to join the conversation. Let's start with Danielle. Hi, Danielle.
Hi, Dan. I just wanted to comment on earlier when you were talking about having to choose between, or some people feeling like they have to choose between family and helping others. I know that that's something that I have struggled with. When I got into the workforce, I thought that the struggle was more being a working mom versus, you know, being home with my children. But as a social worker, I've found that the biggest struggle is being emotionally drained when I come home from working with my clients. And then not feeling like I have enough to give to my family. And then also, when I have a client who's in the middle of a crisis, do I leave the situation? Do I get home to my child? Do I take the time to go to her school and be involved? Or do I stay with my client? It's a big struggle almost every day of my workday.
Emily, I'd like to hear you weigh in on this first before Christine.
Well, I think, first of all, I mean, thank you for your service. It's people like you who really, I mean, who are doing just the great work of society and making that sacrifice so that other people don't have to. I think, I mean, there's some research suggesting that, you know, maybe taking kind of restorative moments, a little break from work so that you don't get too burned out, ultimately helps kind of productivity in the long run so that you're there both for the people who you're working with in your social work, but also for your children. And I know that in the moment it probably feels like, well, if I take any kind of break or if I decide to go home to my kids and I'm not doing what I'm tasked to do at work, but maybe taking a more long-term perspective, it would make you, you know, it'll help you be more productive and more there for your clients and for your family emotionally and otherwise.
Danielle, let me weigh in here as a fellow clinician, as I am. This phenomenon of burnout or being exhausted at the end of a day for giving too much, I think we need to change perspective on that. I mean, I work with people who suffer every day also, but at the end, you know, their suffering is their suffering and my suffering is mine. And my job is to use whatever I have in my head and mostly whatever I have in my heart to help them. But I can't take responsibility for their lives, even when they live with injustice, even when they suffer. I can't take them on my shoulders, nor can anyone take my suffering on their shoulders. So it's really important to work with an open, compassionate, kind heart without taking responsibility for things you just can't manage.
Absolutely. I know that I've used the time on days particularly hard, and my daughter picked up on it right away. I try to use that time to explain to her, not go into depth with what's going on with my clients, but try to explain that she has this wonderful life and not everybody does, in the hopes that one day she would grow up and when she's taking that freshman seminar and that survey that she, one of her goals is to help other people and she's not checking off money and power. And so I try to use it the best I can.
Yeah, and, bless your heart for what you do. Danielle, thanks so much for your call. You know, Christina, you know, I say to my fellow clinicians, and, you know, do what you do, but do it as an act of love, not as a bunch of shoulds. You know, do whatever you do as an act of love, and you know, you'll likely feel richer at the end of the day.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Anytime that we can identify the meaning that we have for other people, and how close that is to our hearts, we're going to have more energy, more motivation. I also, my heart just goes out too, because I think our workplaces have become so overwhelming, right? Especially for people who work for government agencies, and I mean, just across the board, though, that we are bombarded with more and more stimulus every day, and that sense of overwhelm creates what researchers call cognitive overload, right? And it makes us feel, well, first of all, it does make us less creative and less able to make quick decisions and less able to resist temptations and to plan and to think clearly and to organize and to remember social information. And I mean, you name it, the things that we need to be good at our jobs, especially good at our jobs helping other people, becomes impacted for the worse when we start to experience that overwhelm or that cognitive overload. And so it might sound overly simplistic, but to the extent that we can start to shelter ourselves and the people that we work with from so much input, so not trying to check our email at the same time we're talking to a client, or just relearning to just do one thing at a time, to just to put away the smartphones that keep bombarding us with things, and then give us this feeling like we just can't do it all, right? That it creates that sense of time pressure and stress and tension, literally tension in our bodies, and the overwhelming sense that it can't all be done.
I was we had terrible storms here recently on the East Coast, and there was 24-48 hours where I had no electricity, I had no cable, and my Verizon was down also, and I had lunch with a couple of my friends that day, and I noticed one of them kept checking the phone. am I going to have it this moment? And all of us were struggling with it. And, there's a word for the experience we were feeling, and it's called withdrawal.
Right.
It's literally withdrawal, physiologic.
Right. It is. There is some evidence that it's physiological, and that because our smartphones trigger that reward system in our brain, that what researchers call variable ratio reinforcement, which, because our phones contain the most relevant thing to human existence, and that is social information, right? So it doesn't matter what we think about when we should be checking our phone, because, the primitive part of our brain responsible for keeping us alive is very, very interested in any social information coming in. And so we just, those two things combined, the social information in our phone and the fact that it happens like a slot machine, that variable ratio reinforcement means that sometimes we get really good information or really helpful or necessary information, and other times it's just a whole lot of nothing. But it keeps us checking. And that is a formula for what looks like compulsive behavior or an addiction. But I would like to remind people that, just because you have email and have a smartphone and get texts and everything else doesn't mean that it has to be a slot machine in your life, right? It's always going to contain that really relevant social information, but you don't have to be a slave to it. It just requires very different behavior than is normal.
Well,
now,
it requires the courage to let go, to not do something our instinct is to do. I want to comment on one of the chapters in your book, the book The Sweet Spot. And one of the chapters is about how to die happy. Now, personally, I'm like Woody Allen. I'd be much happier if I didn't have to die. But well, so what do we need to do to die happy?
Well, the whole chapter heading is How to Die Happy, Giving, and Beloved, right? So the answer in there is related to everything that we've been talking about. And it's, you know, if you want to die happy, you also need to die giving, right? So we, our greatest happiness, if you look at not just sociology or psychology, but also anthropology and all the sort of social sciences that we have over the last 100 or so years, the single strongest finding we have about happiness, again and again and again, is that a person's happiness is best predicted by the breadth and the depth of their connections to other people, by their social ties. And not just one type of social tie, but all kinds of positive social ties. So it's, you know, whether or not you feel connected enough in your local coffee shop to chat up the barista and to make eye contact with the other people in line and smile at them as much as having a you know, close friend that you could get to see on most days, or getting along with your colleagues or your family members. So so that is what we know. We know that our relationships are what give us the most meaning and fulfillment and that sort of deep, more profound happiness.
And now as writers, as sociologists, as psychologists, it's all of our responsibility now to teach it. I just want to conclude with a brief vignette. I was in California years ago with hanging out with a dear friend of mine. And she took me to see the redwoods for the first time. And for those who have never seen them, these are buildings. They're just amazing structures to watch. And she said to me, you know, Dan, for such big trees, they have shallow root structures. And I said, so how do they stand? Where do they get their stability? She says, these trees grow close to each other and the roots interlock. Mm. And that's how they get their strength. And that's kind of the point we have all been making this whole show. I want to thank both of you so much for joining us today. It's really been an interesting show.
Thank you for having us. It was wonderful. I really enjoyed our conversation.
And I did too. Thanks.
Yeah, I did too.
Both of you.
I did too.
Today's guests have been Christine Carter. She's a senior fellow at Greater Good Science Center and the author of two books, The Sweet Spot and Raising Happiness. Also joining us today was Emily Estefani Smith. She writes for many publications, and she has a blog. Follow us at Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. Our email address is voices@whyy.org. And please reach out to me. I'm at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Adam Staniszewski. Thank you, Adam. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott's our producer. Leah Kaufman's our intern. Larry Roebling produces Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week.